Hello and welcome once again to Breakfast All Day. The three of us are here. It's a beautiful, it's a glorious day.
Yeah.
It really is. We've got a lot to talk about. I'm Christy, and that's Lonzo, and that's Matt. Say hello, fellas.
Hello, fellas.
I'm under-caffeinated, but Matt's over-caffeinated, so it'll balance out nicely.
Or am I?
I could have gotten you some coffee. I offered you coffee or tea or water
I'm trying to drink less, and I think I cut back too much on day one. Oh.
We have all the beverages are here at Breakfast All Day. I could have made you fresh squeeze orange juice.
I need to taper better.
We really should be having mimosas for
Breakfast All Day. We should. We have an orange tree. It is California. We have an orange tree in our backyard.
Right. Also, I'm going to call out to everybody watching this on YouTube that my apologies because I've been the one slow to put up all the videos. So blame me.
So if you've been on tenterhooks for those last two True Detective recaps on video...
We'll get them up soon, and then we're also going to have a new thing that I'm excited to introduce called Breakfast All Day a la Carte. These are interviews with people who work in film or pop culture or entertainment, or they're just friends of ours
people
who are interesting.
Like. You should call it In the Breakfast Nook.
In the Breakfast Nook, but I like it. It's a la carte. It's like okay, a side order. Like, all you want is a side of hash browns.
Okay.
All you want is, like, one scrambled egg, right? You're ordering it. Off the menu, a la carte. It's different.
Fair
so Matt and I had a wonderful discussion with the artist Shag, which was so much fun, and he was a sweetheart, so we had a good time talking with him. That will be up over the weekend, so look for more of those in the future, more interviews and chats with people we think are interesting that we hope you will also think are interesting. But we're going to start out with Captain Marvel.
Yes.
The long-awaited, finally, a Marvel movie with a female superhero at its center, mm-hmm. with a woman directing it, co-directing it. Brie Larson plays Captain Marvel. Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck co-directed and co-wrote this with a bunch of other writers. And it is, it's the origin story of Carol Danvers. Right?
And of Nick Fury, in a way.
And of Nick Fury, in a way. Right.
Or at least...
And Coulson.
And Coulson.
Right?
Sort of.
So I don't want to spoil things, but you guys know this takes place in the 90s,
yep.
right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
That's a given. They lean very hard on the 90s nostalgia.
Yeah.
I mean,
she literally lands in a blockbuster.
She literally crash lands into a blockbuster, and they spent a ton of money on music here. Like, name a 90s girl power anthem, and it is in it, from TLC to some particularly on-the-nose use of Just a Girl by No Doubt.
No Spice Girls, though, now that you mentioned
No
girl
Spice
power.
Girls,
but definitely others.
But
all the sort of, like, female-fronted kind of grungy bands, for sure. Right.
Elastica.
Like, garbage.
Hole.
They're making an appearance. Yeah.
So Carol Danvers... We first see her. She does not know who she is. She is in the midst of some war zone. She, we find out, is a warrior living and training on the Kree planet of Hala.
Hala!
I swear to God, we didn't plan that. We're just all on the same page.
Or maybe it's actually, I think it's pronounced Hala.
Hala, right.
It's very good French toast.
Yeah. Oh, good Lord. So... Oh, we're punchy. So Carol Danvers is being trained by Jude Law. She is consistently being told to keep her emotions in check because girls, we're emotional. We get our period and everything goes haywire.
You and your dumb feelings.
You and your menstrual cycles. So you know, it's very on the nose with its messaging in a lot of ways as far as trying to upend sexist notions of, you know, what women can and should do. And she has to... She crash lands on Earth. There's a MacGuffin-y, sparkly cube thing that she's after.
Cube, you say?
Yeah, it's a thing. It's a thing that's sparkly. Anyway, there's a war going on between the Kree and the Skrulls. The Skrulls are led by Ben Mendelsohn. Anyway, she has to go to Earth, and in the process of going to Earth, she figures out who she actually was, and she was a test pilot. She was a rare female test pilot. Annette Bening was her mentor there, and it's how she finds out who she is while also trying to save her people or something.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on. I really wanted to love this movie. I'm a big fan of Brie Larson. She is great in everything. Short Term 12, Room, name it. She's got a really fascinating and very accessible and very authentic screen presence to her. And there's so little to her character here. I mean, her chief characteristic is that she is She's a rebel. She's plucky and she's a rebel. And we see, you know, some flashbacks to her youth when she's knocked down and she gets up again. You're never going to keep her down.
That's right. But they don't use that song.
They don't use Chumbawamba, sadly. And I feel like her journey would have been richer if her character had been better developed.
Well, I mean, I think to be fair, she does spend much of the movie not knowing who she is. So it's hard to get to know her because she doesn't know her. But I do think that the fact that she's having to sort of reconstruct her past and figure stuff out makes for a more interesting origin story.
Because we're along for the ride.
Because we're along for
that.
The ride. Yeah, because we don't. Because it's not being delivered to us in the sort of ABC order. We get these flashes and snippets that she's trying to figure out, and we're trying to figure out, and you know, eventually it kind of comes together. So I think that building her as a character is something that will come later. Like I tend to like the second Marvel movie of a certain character more than the first one. I mean, there are exceptions, but like, you know, I think the Thor movies get better. I think the Captain America movies get better after the first one.
The Iron Man movies don't get better.
That's the exception.
That started out really strong.
Yes,
the first Iron Man's great.
It was, but then it goes downhill from
there. I think Ant-Man and the Wasp is better than Ant-Man. So I think that we have to sort of put all the pieces on the board. And then now that we've done that, future Captain Marvel installments, I think, will allow her to be richer and more interesting.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I mean, she has wonderful chemistry with Nick Fury. We see young Nick Fury. We see a de-aged Samuel L. Jackson, and it's seamless. We also see young Coulson. Clark Gregg comes back and plays Coulson.
Yeah. With more hair than Clark Gregg has ever had.
I was going to say, the effects aren't quite so seamless with Clark Gregg, but a lot of the fun of the film comes from her banter with Nick Fury. Totally. As they feel each other out and get to know each other. You know, she's good with a quip, Brie Larson. But go ahead, Matt, you're going to say something.
Yeah, I like this movie a lot, more than I think you guys did. I went in this kind of expecting to like it and hoping to like it. So
I was too, Matt.
And I was pretty satisfied with it. It's not at all what I expected. And it, you know, it's almost like it's kind of almost configured a little bit like a mystery. Like you kind of don't know what's going on. It kind of just dumps you into things. And there's, you know, you obviously get the sense that there's more going on than you really realize. And that's okay. That worked really well. I had a really great time. The chemistry, you're right, between Larson and Jackson, I would watch the hell out of a buddy cop movie with them because I thought that they were terrific. And you see a glimpse of that when they did their Oscar presentation. Like they've got really good timing playing off of each other. But I had a really fun time in this. I thought Ben Mendelsohn was this really fun villain that is like, you know, weirdly casual in places that you kind of don't expect. And I thought that was really funny. Like he gets, you know, he's irritated with the, you know, kind of the like dumb thugs working for him.
Yeah. I kind of feel like now when Ben Mendelsohn shows up in a movie, I was like, just cause like, I kind of know what I'm going to get just not because of him, but just because of the kind of stuff that he gets cast in. And this feels like, a much more interesting sort of bad guy role for him to play.
Yeah, he toys with those expectations a bit here. Yeah. But again, like all of those supporting characters are better developed and are more compelling than the woman at the center. Like she's the straight person at the center and the anchor in the sea of all of these big personalities. Right. Well, I wanted more for her.
Black Panther was the same way for me. Whereas I liked him as a character and I was interested, but I was way more interested in all the supporting characters and the women and in Killmonger and, you know, so I think that's sometimes it's like if you look back at the Batman movies, usually the villain is far more interesting. So I think it's the first movie syndrome and then they can sort of make her more interesting as we move along. I had a good time with this. I was consistently entertained. I thought there were some fun surprises. This movie plays around with Marvel canon in a way that I thought was pretty daring.
Right.
There are some things that if you have watched all these movies, there are some cool stuff. But also, if you have never seen these movies, I feel like you can get into this and not feel completely lost.
Yeah, because since it's set in the 90s, it is almost sort of a prequel to the entire MCU. So you could...
You're forgetting, of course, Captain America.
You're right.
Right. Okay. So this is the second prequel.
It's the second prequel.
Okay. Right. But speaking of the 90s stuff, I want to ask you guys, do you feel like the effects in the big action sequences are intentionally a little cheesy to keep with the 90s vibe because they lean really hard on the 90s nostalgia from, you know, people tying flannels around their waist and all the music and the Blockbuster video and, like, you know, two-way pagers. And we were so lame. Dial-up, you know?
The early internet.
We were so lame.
That was a funny bit.
Yeah, that was.
Like, I mean, but it's borderline Ready Player One in terms of, like, ooh, there's a thing, there's a thing, there's a thing. Ooh, right, look, the 90s were so lame. Look at us now.
I mean, they lean a little hard on it, but it didn't tip into Ready Player One.
But did the effects look a little cheesy, like jarringly cheesy to you for an MCU movie? And do you think that was an intentional aesthetic choice to be consistent with the fact that it's a movie set in the 90s and perhaps is made to make you feel like it was also made in the 90s?
I didn't find them jarring.
No.
I didn't notice them being bad or cheesy or anything.
Did you see it in 2D or 3D?
Two.
Me too.
Yeah, I saw it in 2D and that didn't bother me either.
Like, there's a scene, that first scene where they're fighting, the Kree are fighting the Skrulls, and it's like on a dust planet at night. Yeah, it's kind of hard to see anything.
That's not just a 90s thing.
but a lot of it's like pew, pew, pew. Like, there's a lot. It felt out of place given the technology that is, you know, pervasive and shiny and impressive in other MCU movies. Anyway, I mean, again, I don't necessarily enjoy these movies because of those scenes. That's not what I'm necessarily there for. But it felt different to me. So I was wondering if maybe that was a thing that you thought too.
I don't know. I mean, like, you know, obviously Fleck and Bowden are new to the MCU and they're new to this kind of movie. Like, their previous stuff is like Half Nelson and Sugar, these very sort of indie character-based dramas. But as we know, you know, the MCU can sort of plug filmmakers into this whole, you know, franchise, and there's enough of a support staff
of the
people that know how to do this stuff that do that stuff.
But because they have such a rich tradition of character-driven indie dramas, I mean, Half Nelson's the movie that put Ryan Gosling on the map. I mean, Sugar's one of the best baseball movies ever made. Yeah. I expected a deeper level of character development than we get here. And maybe it's just because it is such a massive behemoth machinery that they weren't as able to imbue their signature writing style
I disagree with you, though, because I think you get a lot of, you know,
when they get to Louisiana, I felt like we got a lot of that.
Right. I think, you know, Danvers is really looking to figure out where she came from and her past. And the more she learns about that, the more you see her, it's not that she was lacking for confidence, but you see her make different decisions in her life. And it's, you know, but she's very much, like, I got the sense that her character all along was, like, she knows who she is to the best of her ability that her memories let her know, right? She's always confident. She's always like, hey, look, I'm doing a job. This is what I'm going to do.
She's plucky.
But then she realizes, oh, you know, as she gets more of her memories, like, oh, those emotions, those feelings, those are a strength.
Yeah.
You know,
the whole movie's a metaphor about a woman taking control of her own power.
Right. And then, you know, she makes, I mean, and I'm not going to spoil it, but you see a decision that she makes by the end of it that's meaningful, that has to do with, you know, that comes from the emotions that we've realized that she's now in touch with.
Yeah. Everything you're telling me is a bug, is a feature.
Yeah. And
okay.
That's what the character's saying.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Okay. I see. Within her. She comes to realize that about herself.
Right. And I think part of that is her relationship with Fury. Although he, you know, arguably, like, he gets probably a little bit more satisfying development because he kind of starts out as this kind of, like, wearied, like, I'm just doing this job and I don't really know what I'm doing. You know, like, he's kind of just going through the motions, and then things happen, and, like, you see a new inspiration for him.
Right. Like, S.H.I.E.L.D. exists, but they're dealing with different
But he's
stuff.
Punching a clock.
Yeah.
Right. Like, S.H.I.E.L.D. exists, but he's basically punching a clock.
To talk about Goose the Cat.
Oh, my God. we can tell you that it's great. Goose is great.
Goose is
good.
Great. And I'm not a cat person at all.
Yes.
But one of the great, instantly joins the ranks of the great screen cats. Like,
yes.
Not since Alien.
And I would say great MCU other human characters, like up there with Rocket and Groot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, it's just, the less you know about Goose, the better, but Goose is awesome. Goose is important.
Actually, and our friend Tom, who reads this stuff, was Goose was, in the comics, is named Chewie after Chewbacca.
Okay.
But has had interactions with Rocket.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Yeah. See, I look forward to that because, again, this is not a spoiler. This character is going to be in the next Avengers movie. We know this. Mm-hmm. This is a thing that's known.
Yeah.
I'm not ruining this.
Yeah, as you know by now, the end of Infinity War was a tease to this, so obviously it's going to come full circle,
right? Yes. And stay for both. There's a couple of credit scenes, so obviously stay for both.
Oh yeah, and they're both good in different ways.
Yes,
they both matter in different ways. Yeah, no, I had fun. I did. I wanted more. But as you say, Alonzo, they often these first ones with a new character. Is a lot of like table setting.
Yeah.
I hear you on that. I do. So what are your numbers? I'm saying 6.
I said 7.4. I had a really good time. It's not, you know, it's kind of in the, I have this ranking list of the MCU movies of the wrap and that I have to update every time I see a new one. And it's firmly in the middle, you know, okay. It didn't blow me away, but I had a great time. And I definitely look forward to the second and third installments.
I do too. Okay.
Matt. I had a great time. I really like this. I like all these movies. This one is in the top half for me, maybe the top third. I give it an 8.3.
Okay. All right. Our number is an 7.2 is our number, and it is at 82% on the tomato meter. So we're now going to talk about Gloria Bell, which is Sebastian Lelio's remake of his own film, Gloria, from a few years back. What, 2011 maybe? Which was great. Chilean director Sebastian Lelio, he has remade in English his own film,
yes.
Starring Julianne Moore in the Paulina Garcia role. So she is a woman in her 50s living in Los Angeles. She is divorced. She has 2 grown kids. And it is about how she tries to find happiness. She tries to find her place in the world. And that means like having the guts to go by yourself to a dance club at night. And I kind of want to go find this place that she hangs out at because it's like all middle-aged people dancing to disco and it's awesome. It's all like singles, like 50-year-old singles dancing to like Donna Summer or whatever it is.
Christy, you're married.
I am married, but it sounds like a fun night.
Whoever did the music supervision of this movie was very spot on in terms of having to do the opposite of what most music supervisors are called to do, which is to like basically find the most obvious right. and the most like popular and the most sort of played out songs, but it does do that thing where it's kind of like when Sandra Bernhardt will take some single that seems really trite and dumb, they haven't thought about it, and she will imbue it with this sense of like, oh my God, this is really deep. And when you hear, you know, when Julianne Moore is in her car singing along to these songs, like she brings this angst to them that you know you might not otherwise think about.
And there's an honesty to that because, like, you know, who doesn't drive around in their car singing along to Olivia Newton-John, you know, A Little More Love? Like,
sure.
She's not very good, and she's driving around in LA going, it gets me nowhere. It's so, there's a lot of truth to a lot of small moments like that.
She does that thing where, like, when the song gets too high, you drop an octave.
I do that. That's true. So she meets John Turturro, who is also divorced-ish and also has grown kids. It took me a long time to ignore the fact that I felt like I was watching Big Lebowski fan fiction in which Maude and the Jesus get together.
I have still never seen the Big Lebowski.
Well, then this won't distract you like it did for me. It's an important film, Alonzo. How do you function on a daily basis in Los Angeles as a film critic? And people are probably quoting Big Lebowski to you all the time.
Because I feel like I know all the quotes. And I know, I mean, it's weird. It's like it's a movie that you sort of like come down with without ever being actually to see it. Like, I feel like I know.
That's just like your opinion,
a ridiculous amount about this movie without ever seeing it. And I know I can't see it in a theater.
Somebody must be showing it. Well, yeah, they do Lebowski Fest every year.
I shouldn't because I don't want to, as a first timer, I don't want to see it surrounded by the inevitable fans that show up. One of these days I will stream it or something.
It's like seeing The Room with people the first time because everyone knows those lines, right? Okay, so Gloria and this guy whose name, of course, now escapes me are...
The Jesus.
Yes, the Jesus. Maude and the Jesus get together. And it seems...
Arnold.
It seems really lovely for a long time and they're both kind of looking for the same thing and they have nice chemistry with each other, but in very subtle ways, it becomes more and more clear that this is probably not going to work.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that throughout this film, she does not compromise who she is.
Yeah.
She continues to be on this path of finding out what's important to her and asserting that over and over again and not necessarily being with a man because she has to be or feels lonely. And I think it's so revolutionary.
There are hints from the get-go that this guy is not going to be as ideal as we hope he's going to be, you know. I really enjoyed this film. And I have to say, I walked into it thinking, why does this movie exist? like Gloria, 2013, I looked it up.
Okay.
You know, it's a recent film, beautifully done, great lead performance. Like, this movie only exists because not enough Americans will go see subtitled movies. And you have to make it for them again in English. And also, when a director remakes his own movie...
That's usually death.
Yeah, like I always flash back to The Vanishing, you know, which is a really terrible version of that. Although Cold Pursuit also was right.
Cold Pursuit was in order of disappearance.
But it was the same guy.
It's the same director. Yeah. And then thing with the with Bryan Cranston in the wheelchair.
Oh,
the
Kevin upside.
Hart. Kevin Hart is his.
But that's not the same director.
It's not the same director.
No, I think
Evil Dead 2 is great, though, and that's basically a remake.
Well, this
of
is
Evil
true.
Dead.
Anyway.
English language remakes tend to suck in general, but also when the director has. Doing his own work.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I went in with a lot of red flags, and I was amazed at how great this is. Like, Julianne Moore's performance is dynamite. You know, you have to sort of buy her as a woman who might be ignored by people, which is hard for somebody like Julianne Moore to play, I would think, but she does it. Like
acting.
Exactly. Acting. Totally. I like that early on, you know, you see her like leaving messages for her kids and you think, oh, is she going to be like clingy and suffocating,
naggy mom?
But she's not. And you get to know over the course of the film that she does actually have a nice relationship with both of them and that they do rely on her for things and they are close. And, you know, certainly they're closer to her than to their father, who we meet at one point, who's played by Brad Garrett.
Brad Garrett and Gene Triplehorn are also in it,
So, and like, all, you know, a lot of the supporting roles are played by interesting actors. Sean Astin is in there briefly in the Vegas sequence, and Michael Cera plays her son. I really like this movie. I mean, it is very much of that 1970s, an unmarried woman. You know, I made the joke earlier, there's two movies this week about women, you know, discovering their own power, this and Captain Marvel.
Yes. One of them will be a literal flaming torch.
Exactly.
Guess which one it is. Yeah.
And then there's Captain Marvel.
No, but the thing with her, like, having her own, like, rich life, like, she will go by herself to, like, one of those classes where you go through laugh therapy. Mm. You know, she's constantly trying things.
Yeah, she goes to her daughter's yoga class.
Yeah, and if she feels a little dorky, that's okay. Like, I love the... It's so life-affirming, and there's so few films of women in this age, and when there are, they don't get a role like this. They don't get this kind of portrayal. They're like someone's mom. They're the naggy mom.
Yeah.
And there's so much more to her. Yeah, it hits a lot of the same beats as the original Gloria.
Yes.
Has a lot of the same moments. The ending is extremely similar, but that does not take away from how joyous the ending is.
Yes.
And how, like, laughter through tears the ending is. It's very happy, sad, and very really sweet.
Even if you saw, like, the first one, you should give this one a roll. Barbara Sacova.
Where has she been?
She pops up every so often. It's like, oh, yeah, you are awesome, Barbara Sacova. this is, for a movie that by rights doesn't even need to exist, it is quite well done, and I think is one I'm going to be thinking about for quite a while.
Yeah, and so Matthew Herbert, who also does the score for, like, all of Sebastian Lelio's films, did the music here. Yeah. And there's kind of a dreamlike quality to
ethereal.
The music, and also just to the way it's shot. There's a lot of, like, gauzy sunlight, which is an interesting contrast with the day-to-day reality of her mundane life. It's almost like she's in the middle of her own fairy tale, but that fairy tale may not end the way, you know, princess stories usually end. So.
They definitely know how to shoot LA, you know, and sort of get that quality of the light and the haze and different things. And downtown versus, like, the valley or wherever it is that he lives, you know, stuff like that. Everyone's going to go see Captain Marvel this weekend, and they should. But, you know, if you're too fancy for superhero movies, or you have time for more than one, also go see Gloria Bell.
Yes, I'm saying 9.
8.5.
And I get the pleasure of this weekend doing a couple of Q&As with Sebastian Lelio for this film. So if you're in L.A. and you want to go see it at the Landmark, I'll be with him on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And I interviewed him a few times last year for Disobedience.
Ah.
So that was just a year ago with Disobedience, if you saw that. And then he won the Oscar a year ago for Best Foreign Language Film for A Fantastic Woman.
Yeah.
So
he's busy, busy.
The lovely Sebastian Lelio is on a roll. So I'm really happy that with this next film, Alonzo's going to describe it, because I don't know how to do it. It is a German film called Transit from writer-director Christian Petzold.
Yes.
And my goodness, is it complicated. complicated. And so Alonzo gets the arduous, unenviable task of trying to describe it to you.
Okay, I think you're overselling this.
I am. But... No, I'm not. It's very confusing.
Okay, so Petzold is adapting a novel that was set during World War II about people trying to get out of Nazi-occupied France. But he has decided to set it in the present day because of the rise of fascism across Europe. But the stakes are the same. People are trying to get visas and letters of transit and you know... To get that, it's very Casablanca, to get out of France because the, you know, I don't know if they ever use the word Nazi, but the Germans have occupied, basically.
They never say the word Nazi, you never see any swastikas.
Right.
But that's clearly what we're talking about.
But yeah, there's clearly like a fascist overrun of the country. So this guy, Georg, helps a friend try to get to Marseille, but the friend is dying, and by the time they get there, he's dead. So Georg reaches out to the guy's wife and child and tries to help them out as much as he can. But one of the things that he had been given before leaving Paris were a couple of letters for a writer who they're trying to get out of the country. He goes to the guy's hotel room and finds that he's dead. And once he gets to Marseille, Georg is mistaken for the writer, which he decides to go with because the writer is getting transit out of the country to go to Mexico. But also in Marseille is the dead writer's widow, who doesn't know that the writer is dead. And the two of them start this relationship that's sort of based on the idea of her still trying to find her husband and her hoping to go to Mexico with him. I guess that's the plot.
That is the plot, but it's really... fascinatingly disorienting for a long time because you can't place it in time because what they're talking about, you know, is clearly post-World War II troubles or in the middle of World War II, even troubles as far as like the Germans invading and people having to get out. And then
they talk about spring cleaning, which is the ethnic cleansing that's been going on in other cities, and the camps have been set up. And so like they're heading to Marseille. So there's like a ticking clock of getting out of town.
And you need papers.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, you'll see like the woman behind the front desk at a hotel and her hair is like in a very retro 1940s hairstyle.
True.
Where you'll see, sailors in the bar where a lot of the action takes place and a lot of people meet and have conversations with each other. And the sailors are like old fashioned, like it could be, Gene Kelly, you know,
and
they're old fashioned sailors. And
there's not a lot of like cell phones or computers in this movie.
There's not. But then when you step outside the bar, it's like modern day. Well, there are like bus stops with like monitors on them.
Yeah.
There's signage. There are ads. The cars are all modern cars.
Yes. Yes.
And so like the luggage is modern, like rollerboard luggage.
When the fascists are picking people up, they have like contemporary vans with sirens on them.
Right. And the uniforms are not old uniforms. So here and there you get glimmers of 1940s aesthetic and in the way people speak to each other and in the way they dress, but mostly it takes place in the present day. And it's really disorienting but not necessarily in an off-putting way, in a way that makes you kind of want to lean in and understand it better.
Well, I think he's basically making the point that you know, history is circular. We are now back in a place where after...
Right, this could happen anytime.
Exactly. After defeating fascism in Europe, oh, look, it's back, you know. And so I think it's a cool idea, but I think it's sort of just an idea in terms of... once you get that, it doesn't really go. There's nowhere else to go with it apart from so this is what we're doing.
It's in the kitchen. It's an old phone in the kitchen that we gave Nick to play games on.
Gotcha.
And people sometimes call it. Sorry.
No worries.
That'll end soon. So
my thing with this movie though is that people love this film and the reviews have been rapturous, and I just am not seeing what they're seeing because. For me, the central relationship of the movie is between Georg and Marie, the widow of the writer, who's played by Paula Beer, who was in François Ozon's France.
And Never Look Away.
She's now in Never Look Away, the Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck movie. But, you know, she and her husband had been estranged, but now suddenly she wants to get back together. And it's like the movie's ever very clear about, like, well, does she love the husband or does she just want the husband as a ticket out of town? And then, you know, the fact that he won't tell her, he tries to tell her that her husband is dead and she won't believe it, but he doesn't say, no, I saw his body and I have his papers and I'm pretending to be him now. That conversation never gets had, so that bugged me. There's narration, which...
Oh, right. There's a narrator.
Which got on my nerves.
And then you got to wonder throughout who's the narrator, which also kind of gives it like a film noir vibe because the narrator is very knowing and like kind of adds embellishments and emotions to the idea of what he's narrating.
I don't know. But I found it a lot of it to be extraneous. I don't know. This movie kind of left me cold, frankly. And, it feels like it's cobbled together from Casablanca and The Passenger.
It's very Casablanca.
Which is the Antonioni movie where Jack Nicholson is traveling with somebody else's papers and gets embroiled in that guy's life, you know. And so, ultimately, I didn't love this.
I really admired the ambition of it, and I really like the central performance from Franz Rogowski as Georg. He's got kind of like a Joaquin Phoenix-ish physicality to him.
He's the... If Vincent Gallo wanted to cast a younger, hotter version of himself in a movie.
But there's something about him that's like... There's like brooding and a little dangerous and a little stoic and a little inscrutable but fascinating that reminded me, and also facially just reminded me of Joaquin Phoenix quite a bit. I was always fascinated by this film and I always wanted to know what was going to happen. I never knew what was going to happen. Once I got past the initial kind of disorientation of it all, I was really into it and I appreciated what it is trying to say about what's happening in the world now without, like, really painfully on the nose saying what's happening in the world
now. Sure, no. I appreciated that as a trope, and I thought it was a cool idea. And he does have that interesting relationship with the kid and the kid's mother, who are both, Middle Eastern, I guess?
They're from Northern Africa somewhere, and they're Muslim.
And so, obviously, they're trying to also, you know, find safety. I mean, there are interesting ideas in the film. It's well acted. I liked the whole sort of playing around with time as far as the setting, but I didn't get swept up in neither emotionally nor just in the ideas of this movie.
People take ships places. They're always like waiting to get on a ship and
there's no airplanes in this movie. It's all about getting on the boat.
I think I'm with you in admiring it more than I loved it, but I was into it the whole time. So I'm saying 7.8.
I said 6.5. I think it does a lot of stuff well, but it just didn't leave me with this that a lot of critics seem to be getting out of it. Like just after I don't read reviews until after I see the movie, but after seeing this, I was looking at the Rotten Tomatoes page and reading up some people, and they were just rapturous. I was like, it's that thing where you're like, wow, I wish I'd seen that movie.
It is at 96% on the tomato meter. So yeah, pretty much everyone adores it. So yeah. I think it opened in New York last week and it's LA this week. Yeah. So it's probably scattering out to the world eventually.
Yeah. Music Box is releasing it. So keep an eye out. If it hasn't gotten to you yet, we will hopefully get there soon.
All right, you guys, we're going to move on to what may be one of the worst movies of the year.
Woo!
We think we've seen it, and it's called I'm Not Here. I wish I hadn't been there, but I was. Matt, please tell us about it.
So this movie is about a character, Stevie, played by J.K. Simmons, and Sebastian Stan, and some little kid. And we see J.K. Simmons at the beginning. He's... looks like about 10 miles of bad road, ridden hard, put away wet. He looks terrible. He's drunk and lives by himself. And you see early on, he's got a gun to his head. And you're not sure what he's going to do. And as the movie progresses, as he walks around his house by himself, every time he sees some object, you get some little bit of his memory either from childhood or early on in his relationship with his wife, or his eventual wife. And this movie is co-written and directed by his wife, by J.K. Simmons' wife, which is kind of explains the only reason why he would have done this, because it's terrible.
Yes, Michelle Schumacher.
Yeah, in spite of a really, pretty strong performance by J.K. Simmons, who's effectively on his own the whole time.
And not saying a single word.
And not saying anything. This movie sucks.
It does. It is ponderous and self-important yet empty. And they try to jump around in time between what I guess is the present day. This was it initially had a festival run in 2017.
It premiered it. I just looked it up at the Rain Dance in London in September of 2017.
Okay, so it's been kicking around for a little while. But yeah, but the way it goes from like the present day to what is his childhood, I'm guessing in the 60s. At one point, they play Daydream Believer on the radio in the kitchen when he's a little boy, when he's a six-year-old boy. So that was 1967,
right?
Whatever. And then you see him in college in the 80s and the way they depict the 80s, the only way they try to create a sense of time and place is by random songs on the radio. Like, they have changed nothing in terms of right. clothing, hair, interiors. Well, at one point they play Words by Missing Persons, and that's how we know it's 1982. But he's in a bathroom with subway tile. I don't know. Things like that things like that bother me. Like, nobody would have subway tile in their bathroom in 1980. I'm really nitpicking here. I appreciate that.
Perhaps you lived in a house that was built before 1980. I mean, you end up with...
The subway tile is a cool thing people do now in their houses.
Okay.
All right. So
anyway, this movie stinks.
It does. And it's a waste of a great cast.
Right. Like, it never, you know, as you get these memory flashbacks, like, they're so cliched. Mm-hmm.
Like what? Give us an example.
So cliched. Like, the, you know, he looks at the little cup and then has the flashback to brushing his teeth as with his mom. And, you know, you see the glimpse of the, you know, the coin from AA, and, you know, you eventually get that. And it's just all these flashbacks that are like, it's just, you know, you start thinking like, okay, what's next? What's the next thing we're going to see? That's the, you know, like, he...
The structure is very obvious.
The structure is very obvious. Yeah. The traumas from his past are mostly pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. And it just never resonates. It never means anything because, you know, whereas, you know, you see at least... With the stuff Simmons is doing, like, you at least, you know, he's got enough charisma and he's enough of a performer that he's kind of interesting to watch. But when they cut back to the scenes with the little kid whose mom is played by Mandy Moore or, you know, the adult played by Sebastian Stan, like, those scenes have no, there's nothing there to them. There's no interest. There's no energy to them at all. And you're just kind of like slogging through. And the other thing is Sebastian Stan is walking around in this movie. I mean, I know he's supposed to be an alcoholic, but he's walking around like completely in a daze this whole time in this movie. And you kind of never realize, I mean, it's almost like he's still the Winter Soldier who's still like not sure who he is. So I just was never involved with the stuff that happened. And then I'm not going to give anything away, but the ending is so nonsensical.
Well, the ending or the post-credit scene?
All of it. All of it. It's just like eventually.
Because there's that,
too. And then there's hints of things where it's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Like, it starts raising questions and then never really answers them. And if it does answer them, it answers them in a way that makes no sense at all. And so by the end of this movie, I'm like, this was 80 minutes I wasted.
Not even. It's like 70 minutes.
Yeah, it's still too long.
So there is nothing to any of these characters to define them beyond alcoholism, right? All we know of J.K. Simmons' character is that he's disheveled, he's in a bathrobe, he's let his life fall apart so egregiously that he's wandering around the house with no electricity on. And yet he has this unlimited supply of vodka he has stashed everywhere. He's found all the vodka, and that's all he does is and then very symbolically, when the batteries are dead in his TV remote, he takes the batteries out of the clock, right? Because time doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or does it? And so he's staggering around. And, yeah, there's a physicality to him that you want to watch.
Wait, there's no electricity. How can you watch television?
That's a great question.
Well, because the power hadn't been turned off.
Right. They've called and threatened to turn off the power, right? Because he's walking around in the house that we later see in flashbacks as the house that he shared with his wife, played by Micah Monroe. Yeah, the defining characteristic of him as the Sebastian Stan version of him in the 80s is that he is a drunk who keeps losing his job. Like, who knows what the hell he does for a living? Does Micah Monroe have a job? Does she do anything? Is there anything to Mandy Moore's character as his mom in the 60s beyond being kind of a nag? Like, she's the one who keeps the house together.
Right.
And the dad at this point is Max Greenfield. So Max Greenfield is also an alcoholic and has some issues. And you see why he drinks so much. You see what he's in hiding from.
And there's things in this movie that should resonate with a certain amount of trauma, and then they never do. And, you know, when you first meet, you know, kind of Sebastian Stan, when you meet Steve is kind of this young man that's supposed to be, you know, full of life. Like, he's up on stage with his buddy half drinking and trying to riff on Schrodinger's cat.
Which is supposed to be very symbolic,
and that doesn't make any sense. No. Like,
he and Michael Monroe have no chemistry with each other. And then one of the flashbacks is the two of them, I think it must be that same night at the open mic night at the bar, because they're having their first drink together.
Right.
And, like, even the banter between them on this first night, like there's nothing. It's right. awkward. It's stilted. It's slow. It's quiet. Like we're supposed to believe this is his life altering love affair that has wrecked him so that he is disheveled right. and destitute. And you just do not get that from these glimmers back in time. Actually the best actor in this thing is Ian Armitage as the little boy, the kid version of the J.K. Simmons and Sebastian Stan figure. There's exactly one good scene in this film. Matt's scowling. He's like looking at me like, what are you talking about?
With the judge
with the jelly beans, where his parents are divorcing when he's like six, and the judge pulls him into his chambers and asks him a bunch of questions.
Right. And even then, that scene starts out like, uh-oh, right? Like that scene's so ham-fistedly directed that even then that starts to be like, oh God, what's going to happen to this mm-hmm. kid? Right. And because you've been hit with so many cliches and so much just like dumb directing choices yeah. that, you know, it's not shot particularly well. It's
not the same scene where Sebastian Stan and Micah Monroe are having their first drink together. Like they're sitting at this little round two top table, whatever. And like a waitress comes up to bring them their drinks and like blocks the entire frame pretty much. It's really weird the way it's shot. We were gonna say something, Alonzo.
No. I knew the name Ian Armitage. I just looked him up. I was like, oh, that kid.
Who is he?
He's young Sheldon, and he's also the little kid in Our Souls at Night. Remember that?
I do.
Redford Fonda movie.
Yeah.
He's
the best.
And he's in Big
part
Little Lies.
Yes, he is the best part of this. He's a good young actor. I hate to say this, but you kind of must assume that all these folks were doing a favor, you know, right. who all signed on for this because it's the script is not great.
Well, like the scene with the sugar, like that could have been a great scene, right? Like there's
he's putting too much sugar,
putting too much sugar, and it's this great long take, and that could have been done really well, but it's just not.
There's no
right?
payoff
there's
to
no
it.
Payoff. There's so little payoff to it, and you know, a better director would have actually kind of telegraphed that and. You know, because the kid goes and gets his cereal and then he starts putting sugar on it. And then there's a point where it's like, oh my God, what's he doing?
What's going to happen?
Right. And, but you're right. There's no payoff. You know, at best you get the mom saying something off screen.
And there are all of these, the way it cuts around in time, there are all these really annoyingly on the nose and very obvious parallels.
Right.
And so like, you know, Michelle Schumacher also edited this film. And so you'll see like, a kid, when Stevie is a little boy at age six, he takes a sip of vodka and then spits it out. And then later on, you will see Stevie as Sebastian Stan and his own little boy, he takes a sip of vodka and spits it out. Like there's over and over again are these really obvious parallels. And it's like, we get it. We get it. You're passing on the alcoholism.
Right.
And I gotta say, if you cannot get me with a movie about alcoholic parents, you are doing something wrong, right? Both my parents were alcoholics when I was a kid. They got sober when I was like 10. So a lot of that he's going through, like,
right.
It should resonate with me, sure. right?
No, I get it. My dad was an alcoholic till the day he died. Like,
right.
Yeah,
and it didn't get either of us. I was like, right.
I'm that way with cancer mom movies.
Right.
If you're not pushing my buttons, you're really not even trying.
Yeah. So anyway, this is not good, but it's short. So Ben would probably like it because it's only 70 minutes long. I'm saying 1.5. This is going to end up on my worst list of the year.
Yeah, I give it a 2. That's probably too high. I'll round mine down to, or not round, but I'll drop mine to 1.5.
Okay, so we're saying 1.5. There's no score yet.
Right. It only gets points for being so short.
So don't see this one. So we're going to play some catch up now with a movie that I suspect we were all kind of dreading having to watch, and that is the 2-part, 4-hour documentary Leaving Neverland about Michael Jackson. Alonzo, please tell us more.
Sure. So it's documentarian Dan Reed talking to two men who share their stories of what they say was repeated years of abuse at the hands of Michael Jackson. James Safechuck, who had done a Pepsi commercial as a little kid and wound up going on the Bad Tour. And then later, Wade Robson, who met the singer when he was 7 and said that their relationship lasted until he was 14. And this is a 4-hour documentary, but it is, I think it sort of takes its time to sort of illustrate how the grooming process works, both with the young people and with their families, the aftermath of the abuse and how it affected their lives, and you know, how it colored their lives as they entered adulthood, and then finally how in becoming fathers themselves they both realized the nature and the reality of what had happened to them, and then their being willing to speak out about it for the first time after having in the past testified on Jackson's behalf at other times when there were trials about this alleged behavior. There was a really good piece that somebody posted on my Facebook wall from about 4 or 5 years ago in the aftermath of the Penn State scandal. And basically talked about how people changing their story is part of the process of being a survivor and overcoming it. It's like there is a whole thing of denial and not wanting to acknowledge it as abuse and not wanting even to maybe acknowledge that it happened, to telling friends and loved ones and, you know, policemen and therapists, no, nothing happened. And then eventually at some point it just breaks and you tell that story. So I don't think it makes them unreliable witnesses that they change their story. It makes them, that is typical behavior for people who have experienced that level of trauma in childhood.
Right. And we are seeing that as well with the Me Too movement, that a lot of women who for a long time, you know, denied it and didn't want to talk about it because they suppressed it. They told themselves what they had to tell themselves to survive psychologically. You know, right. We're seeing this here now as well. Yeah. A lot of what Wade Robson and James Safechuck have said has been shot down by a lot of folks because Wade Robson testified at the Michael Jackson trial in the mid-2000s. You know, Michael Jackson was acquitted of the charges against him. And because, you know, Macaulay Culkin and the other boy who was very prominent, Brett Barnes
and also
Jordan,
Corey Feldman,
all of them have said, no, he never touched me. And so that is supposed to theoretically absolve Michael Jackson, whatever. And the idea that, oh, he was a genius and he loved children and he did so much great charity work, and you know he was deprived
of a childhood himself.
Yeah. But he
loved children.
Right? Have you seen his childhood?
Exactly.
Do you want to build a snowman?
I mean, there is something weird about like that level of fame and what we as a society sort of ignored and looked away from. I don't think is ever going to happen again. Mm-hmm. Like I think that Kara Brown was talking about this on Keep It. It's sort of like you look at the Harvey Weinstein story and that's a failing in the industry, and you look at the R. Kelly story and that's a failing in the industry and also in the city where, you know, he lived and where he was, you know, perpetrating his crimes. But like Michael Jackson, that's a failure of the world because we all sort of saw all this weirdness going on and we just decided that because we liked the music so much and because he had, you know, endured this terrible childhood with, you know, his father, that was just going to be fine.
But you know, one of the things that as we talk about this and that pattern, for instance, makes me think about is that, do you guys see the Barry Crimmins documentary?
Mm-mm.
about him realizing on, this was the guy who was kind of the mentor to Bobcat Goldthwait. And he had this onstage breakdown where he kind of realizes and starts talking about his own abuse as a kid.
I've heard about that.
Right, and it's amazing. That documentary is unbelievable. And one of the things, and it blows me away in the documentary, is that he talks about forgiving his abuser because he says, we know from the evidence over and over and over and over again that people who abuse children were abused as children. And so you, like, sexually abused as children, and they go on to sexually abuse children. And it makes you think, like, what did happen with Michael Jackson?
Indeed, yeah. Right. Did you watch the Oprah follow-up?
I did not. Did you?
I did. Okay. And she actually brings up the notion of forgiveness and forgiving Michael, forgiving yourself, forgiving your parents. And they're all at sort of various stages of that, you know, that path. Mm-hmm. But she also talks about, she has other people, a lot of people in the audience were themselves abuse survivors, and some of them are advocates. Like there's a doctor in the audience who had been on her show a bunch, and then Anthony Edwards is there, because you recall he came out a few years ago about what had happened to him. He has an organization now called One in Six, which is the what's estimated the number of American men who are sexually abused as children. And he talks about sort of, you know, when they're doing the whole thing about how they had testified at the trial and how they had denied it for years. He says, like my mother would always ask me and I would always say no, nothing happened, because I felt like if I talked about it and I admitted everything that had happened, it would just all fall apart. Like my entire life, basically, because everything in my life had been about what that moment meant and then getting past that moment, and to acknowledge that actual moment could just collapse the entire house of cards. So the movie is very methodical in terms of, like, you know, setting up the timelines and setting up the, you know, the process by which, you know, how do they meet Michael? How does Michael ingratiate themselves into the family? How does he then start, you know, like pushing the parents further right. away and bringing the children closer?
While also insinuating himself with the parents. Like yes. he was still faxing Wade Robson's mom. I mean, right. you know, there's still, he wants the parents to be close, but then he's like poisoning the kid's brain against
exactly.
his own mom and dad.
And like constantly pressing them on like secrecy and not telling anybody. And we'll both go to jail for the rest of our lives if this ever gets out. You know, and then the process by which they get replaced by the new boy and then sort of feel sort of left out about, you know, kind of not sure what to do with themselves. And then, you know, as soon as Michael needs them to come testify, suddenly, uh-huh. you know, the charm offensive begins again and they get sort of swept back up into it. It's, you know, and from what I've read about it, like, the director was saying, you know, the dates match up, everything they talked about, like we were in Paris, we, you know, this had that happened, that like it all tracks based on just sort of, you know, objective research as far as where the Michael Jackson tour was then and all that kind of stuff. And so I believe them, you know.
I believe them too. And what's fascinating is, and kind of sickening, is the pattern of it.
Yeah.
That both of these boys kind of looked alike as boys, and both were massive Michael Jackson fans and really gifted dancers. I mean, Wade Robson especially has gone on to this tremendous career
yeah.
as a choreographer during like peak NSYNC and peak Britney Spears.
Right.
And he does So You Think You Can Dance stuff. And so they're both really gifted, talented kids who Jackson brought them both on stage. Jackson brought them both on tour as men. Now they both kind of look alike. And yeah, and both of them did find that when they did finally admit this, it did all fall apart for them. Like, and that breakdown was necessary to work through and to heal. But yeah, I do believe them. It's a really grueling film to watch. It's really sickening.
Yeah,
and it's heartbreaking.
It's a tough 4 hours.
And it premiered at Sundance, and they had counselors in the lobby waiting in case you walked out of this film and felt like you needed to talk about it or you needed
right.
to share
or it
something.
Brought stuff up for you. Or,
right.
Yeah, right.
No, and I've heard people on Twitter saying, like, if you are a survivor yourself, you know, give yourself a break. Maybe don't see this movie, or maybe like take breaks and pause and stop and walk away from it and take a deep breath and come right. back to it. So I understand it is going to be a very hard watch right. for a lot of people.
For damn sure, don't try and do what I tried to do, which was watch it all in one sitting last night.
I did that actually.
How'd that go?
You're a better man than I.
Well, no, what happened was I started watching it Sunday night when part one had aired, and as soon as it was over, I was like, oh, what happens next? Where is this all going? And they immediately put both parts on HBO Go, so I was able to just bam, put part two on.
Oh.
And then a couple nights later, I watched the Oprah follow-up interview with the two survivors and the director.
I should watch that. I watched it in pieces just out of necessity, schedule-wise. So
sure.
I think I watched it like an hour at a time at various points in time, and that was digestible, but still quite harrowing as a mom, of his mom of a little boy who's is about the age of these kids when they were involved with him in these horrifying ways. And it's hard to hold these two ideas in your head, but both of them still say, like, I loved him. I loved him. You know, yeah. he was doing horrific stuff to them. And they both describe it in very matter-of-fact, almost clinical detail.
Well,
but they both also acknowledge afterward, like, I still loved him and I wanted to protect him. And like Wade Robson even says, I didn't want to testify to the truth because I didn't want to envision Michael Jackson in prison.
Right. Well, I mean, James Safechuck talks about they exchanged vows.
Right.
Like
right.
Michael put a ring on him and like they, you know, that they vowed that they were going to be together forever, you know? So yeah, it's hard to kind of remove yourself from that. And one of the things that Oprah says is when people talk about sexual abuse, they think that it's all like horrifically violent rape. And it's like, no, the sad truth or the truth that you have to acknowledge in talking about these subjects is that, you know, if you're a 7-year-old boy and somebody puts their hand on your penis, it feels good. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean that that's not abuse. But, you know, it when it's happening to you, you don't necessarily understand the violation that's taking place as a child. You aren't fathoming it until later.
Plus, he had this, you know, he was Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
You know, there's the cult of personality. He was the right. idol to both of these people.
Exactly.
But these are kids. They don't know any better,
no,
right?
No,
like,
not at all.
I mean,
but the moms, theoretically, right. should have. And
well,
that's a fascinating part of this, too, is that both moms are interviewed, and they acknowledge, like, I asked my son, and, you know, it didn't seem weird to me that their hotel room was down the hall or was a whole entire floor away, but, or they were sleeping in the same bed in Neverland and I was in a different wing of the house.
But it doesn't start out that way, right? Because it starts out where, like, I think it's Safechuck's mom is talking about, well, you know, my son wanted to stay with Michael, and no, that was inappropriate. He had to stay with me.
But eventually,
right? So it's not, you know, again, it doesn't just start out. It's not like the kids are strapped down and right.
He works his way into that family where they're like they're driving to Brentwood to come get him and sneak him out in the car away from all the paparazzi to go hang out in their house in Simi Valley. It's like Michael Jackson could have gotten himself there if they wanted to, but bringing them into it makes them feel like, oh, you're rescuing me. Havenhurst.
But yeah, but like the, you know, Jimmy Safechuck's mom was doing his laundry. You know, he was another child to her. And then eventually they acknowledge, the moms acknowledge, I got caught up in this life. We were flying first class. It was exciting. It was intoxicating to be in the middle of, you know, Michael Jackson. It's insidious.
It doesn't start out that way. It's a step, you know, I mean, it probably took months to get to the point where the abuse is actually happening.
Yeah. Right? He groomed them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not an easy sit, but it's an important film, I think. And it raises interesting discussion. So I think people should see it.
Yeah. I think the second half drags a bit. That last hour, they really drag it out quite a bit. It feels a bit repetitive in terms of the territory that it covers. And some of the interviews kind of say the same thing over and over again. But you also need that perspective of how the abuse informed the men and the fathers that they would become. They both get married. They both have sons of their own, and you need that stuff.
That aspect reminded me of Minding the Gap. In that it takes becoming fathers themselves for people to sort of realize what happened to them in their childhoods that could be considered abusive, and how do they end that cycle? You know.
Anyway, it's really good, but it's really hard to watch. I'm saying 8.
I also said 8.
It's at 97% on the tomato meter. So yeah, that's on HBO on demand, or they're showing out the time.
Now, yeah.
So you can watch it if you so choose.
Thanks for watching. You can leave us a positive review or leave us a thumbs up here at YouTube and subscribe to our channel. You can also listen to this show as a podcast, and it's available at Spotify and Stitcher and all the places where podcasts live, and you can leave us positive feedback there as well. And do follow us online. We're at BeFastAllDay on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for watching.
Thanks for watching. And next week is a really busy week. Matt, you're not going to be here.
Correct.
Alonzo, you will be here.
Yes.
Wonder Park opens and lots of busy stuff.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
We'll talk about it. So thanks for sticking around with us, and keep an eye out for the Shag interview over the weekend. Bye.
Bye.